Chicago, I would say good afternoon, good morning, but here it's good afternoon.
Thank you.
And we'll welcome you all to our sitting here at the IU Law School in Bloomington. First case this morning is U.S. versus Westmoreland. Ms. Berger.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I've been appointed to represent the appellant Guy Westmoreland in this case, and we're here appealing the District Court's denial of his 2002 pro se motion for a new trial, which was based on newly discovered evidence regarding two significant issues in this case. In addition, there are a number of constitutional issues that also play in and factor into our motion for a new trial and may as well provide separate grounds for dismissal. Now, in regards to the newly discovered evidence, Your Honor, the first piece of evidence, it was a very key issue regarding the timeline of the affair in this case between the prosecution's key investigator, Agent Martin Milkovich, and my client's then-wife, Ronnie Westmoreland, who was also a star witness for the prosecution against him and testified under a grant of immunity. Now, before my client's murder trial in 2001, the government discovered, they learned of the affair through an anonymous tip, and at that point in time, they disclosed the fact of the affair to my client. However, the government's rationale for why this particular affair caused no harm to my client was that because, according to the government, the affair began in November of 1999. And that's significant because in this case, my client was convicted for the earlier drug offenses in the summer of 98, and he was not indicted for the murder charges until the summer of 99. So the crux of the government's investigation into the murder charges occurred between mid-98 and mid-99. Now, in 2002, after his conviction, my client learned through two new witnesses that were neighbors of his at the time that the affair actually began much earlier than the government originally stated, and that it did begin in 1998. And those witnesses provided sworn statements. They were detailed affidavits describing numerous encounters between Agent Milkovich and Bronnie Westmoreland. And we would submit, Your Honor, that if the jury had been privy to this information, it would have changed the landscape of their deliberations.
Ms. Berger, one of the key issues here is how new this information actually was. Could you address the import of Mr. Westmoreland's ex parte supplemental response to the government's motion in limine regarding this issue, which was filed back in before the murder trial, May of 2001, where he said defendant has information from a witness that Milkovich and Bronnie Westmoreland were together as early as February or March of 1998. Doesn't that indicate that this was not new?
There was an affidavit that his sister, actually, at the time, Tina Kuhl, had submitted, and the court discussed this issue in a motion in limine. However, the court found her testimony not to be credible because she had been discredited as a witness, according to the court and the prosecution, for her role in allegedly obstructing justice and destroying evidence. So there was no way for him to know that two witnesses that had no tie to the case and had no motive to...
Before trial... The issue is known. A witness has come forward. Is the reference in that document I just quoted to his sister, Ms. Kuhl?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Why isn't that at least notice to investigate further?
Your Honor, and again, it's unclear exactly. My client was represented by another attorney at that particular time, so it's unclear what investigation did take place. It would give him some indication that the timeline was potentially different. We don't know who he spoke with, where he conducted his investigation, if he had found these witnesses before. But we do know that they came forward after the trial, and that's based on the record, Your Honor. And on a related note...
I want to back up just a little bit and make sure I understand this. Your motion is directed at the murder-related convictions. Is that correct? Not at the drug conviction?
Yes, Your Honor, because the drug conviction occurred in 1998, before the bulk of this investigation, and the timeline of the affair would only have impacted the jury's deliberations in the murder trial. So that is correct, Your Honor. And actually, all of our counts are directed to the 2001 convictions.
All right.
And on a related note, I do want to point out, I know that we discussed this issue in more detail in our brief, but there may be a separate due process concern that rises from this affair. The fact of the matter is that Agent Milkovich was the central investigator in this case. He was the gatekeeper of information. He was responsible for interrogating suspects, meeting with witnesses, gathering evidence. And again, the fact that he clearly had a legitimate motive in gathering evidence against my client in terms of his role as the chief investigator. But once it became known that he was having an affair with my client's wife, that creates a separate personal motive. And it's very unclear if those two motives merged at any point in time, which could create a due process concern under Russell, and other circuits have recognized.
Russell doesn't really create a standard. And our circuit has rejected the idea. And the cases that adopt this sort of due process outrageous conduct defense seem to be primarily cases of kind of entrapment light, entrapment where some element is missing. What standard do you think we should adopt if we were to recognize for the first time this defense?
Your Honor, in terms of a standard, and I agree that Russell does not lay one out, and neither do the other cases, but for this circuit, the standard to me would be that if the conduct is so outrageous that it is unclear whether or not the appellant would have been convicted but not for this conduct, then I would say that that is something that would be a very important issue for the court to consider. And that's what we're having here, Your Honor. There's no way to know what impact this relationship had on the investigation. And for that reason, we would just respectfully request that the court consider a due process concern as well.
Well, it was certainly explored at the murder trial that there was the relationship, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Former wife was cross-examined about that pretty extensively?
She was cross-examined on this issue, Your Honor. Milkovich did not testify because the government chose not to call him. But in terms of the timing, again, the timing itself was not a huge issue with the trial. It was more just establishing that the affair had happened because we did not have this credible evidence from new witnesses showing that the timeline really was a disputed issue.
Let's go back to that problem, though, because I'm very concerned about where your reasoning would take us. It's not unusual in criminal cases, for example, for a defendant to have an alibi witness who's got credibility problems. Mm-hmm. Ordinarily, we would expect a defendant and his attorney in that situation before trial to work as hard as they can to find out if there are other witnesses who don't suffer the same kinds of credibility problems rather than save only for after a trial, after a conviction, a new challenge like this.
Your Honor, and I do understand the concern. Again, I was not appointed at that time, so I don't know what type of investigation occurred. It could be that they went door to door and they just weren't able to meet with these witnesses. But we do know that those witnesses offered up evidence in 2002. And in addition, my client also offered up evidence in 2004 regarding a material statement that Agent Milkovich had recanted from prior to the trial. And just to give a little bit of a backdrop, before my client's 2001 trial, Agent Milkovich had stated under oath in several instances that at the time my client was arrested, he stated that he did not know anything about a murder for hire. And that was significant. And he stated this during the interrogation and his arrest. And this was significant because at that particular point in time, no one had mentioned a murder to hire for him. So that becomes obviously an incriminating statement. In 2004, a friend of my client, Steve Corris, as well as one of his sisters, Renee Westmoreland, met with Agent Milkovich just because they were trying to dig up some additional information on the case because it was still pending at that time. And he informed them that at the time my client was arrested, he actually didn't say anything. He lawyered up. And that is a significant divergence from the earlier testimony. And while it's true he did not testify at the 2001 trial, one of the other agents in the case, Calvin Dye, did. And this information would have been useful to show the jury that in regards to this very significant statement that's inculpatory, you have two diverging accounts from the two lead investigators in the case. And we would argue.
Why is that new evidence, though? There were three people in the room, right? Dye, Milkovich, and your client.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. It was a little vague from the trial transcript in terms of Calvin Dye's testimony, whether he was actually present, but the government does say she was present, where he was present, so it would be the three of them.
So how is this new evidence? Witnesses recant all the time, right? and we don't undo convictions or simply because a witness who is now alienated from the side. This is after he got fired, right? Because of having the affair with
right,
the,
he was fired, I believe, target. In 2004.
And
yes, Your Honor.
So then he recants.
Yes, Your Honor.
This particular key detail. Mm-hmm. Why should we believe what he says now in 2004 as opposed to his earlier testimony when he was still with the state police?
Well, Your Honor, that would, because it goes to such a material issue, the court, the district court, could have decided to hold an evidentiary hearing at the time, and that issue could have been vetted. The prosecution could have asked questions. This court could have asked questions, and that opportunity was never afforded to my client. So we would argue that this was a material statement that would have mattered before the jury and that the court erred in summarily dismissing it. And this factor is the fact that the court dismissed this motion is even greatly more prejudiced by the fact that my client did not have an attorney.
How do you get it into evidence at the murder trial if Milkovich doesn't testify?
Well, Your Honor, it could come in
hearsay.
Certainly, Your Honor, we wouldn't be offering it to prove the truth that he actually didn't. He actually said that, you know, that he actually said it was remained silent and lawyered
relevant
up.
If it's,
it would be relevant for impeaching.
Impeaching
and
whom?
For Calvin Dye. Calvin Dye testified at trial that...
Impeach Dye with something that Milkovich says some years later.
Well, Your Honor, you would be...
Dye doesn't testify that Milkovich said X. Dye testifies that your client said X.
Correct, but it shows an inconsistency that would come in, again, not to prove that it actually happened, but to identify that inconsistency between the testimony.
It's just straight
hearsay.
And
well,
external
Honor,
evidence of contradiction.
Your Honor, we would argue that it would likely come in, as an impeachment tool. And
impeachment of whom?
Again, the impeachment of Dye. Yes, and here...
Going around and around about
yes, Your Honor. And one of the
you can't call Milkovich just to impeach him, right? You would agree with
that. That is correct, Your Honor.
And this is not Milkovich's, or this is not Dye's recantation. This is Milkovich.
Correct. But again, it would come in, it would just be to show that there was an inconsistency. And one thing I do want to highlight is that, you know, my client filed a motion seeking to compel Milkovich to testify, largely in part because he was trying to establish whether or not there was an issue with the timeline, and the court rejected that motion, in large part because there was not that newly discovered evidence showing that the timeline began earlier. So if we'd had that evidence, Milkovich likely would have testified at any rate, and we would have been able to offer it as an inconsistent statement of some sort.
Milkovich would have testified for whom?
He would have testified for the prosecution. I guess he would be testifying. We would be calling him because we would be calling him. Westmoreland would be calling him.
To give favorable testimony?
No, he would be calling him for purpose. Your Honor.
You can't call him to impeach him, right? We've agreed on that.
Yes, Your Honor. But he would be calling him basically an adverse witness. And I see that I'm butting into my rebuttal time. I do want to make two very quick points before I turn the floor over to Assistant U.S. Attorney Tom Leggins. One, my client didn't have an attorney for 7 years while this motion was pending, from 2003 to 2010. He filed motions in 2003 and 2004 requesting counsel. And this court in Kitchen in 2000 was very clear that the right to counsel attaches for a Rule 33 motion. And he was denied that right.
He had counsel at the time he filed the motion.
He did have counsel,
and
Your
that counsel refused to join in submitting these particular arguments. Correct.
That is correct. That attorney.
Why doesn't that answer this problem?
Mm-hmm. Well, because if you look at the language of Kitchen, Your Honor, the analysis there is whether or not the right attaches for the motion. It's not just a timing issue. It's a timing issue in the sense that you have to file it before your direct appeal is decided. But the actual purpose for having counsel for Rule 33 motions is because, as this court noted, Rule 33 motions have a substantial outcome on the underlying proceedings. And so had he had an attorney, we would have been able to avoid some of the prejudice in the case, and the attorney would have been able to prepare his reply papers in 2004 to the government's opposition. That would have been incredibly useful to his defense. But, Your Honor, I see my time is up, and unless the court has any other questions, we will rely on our briefs for the remaining arguments.
These light systems, I believe your rebuttal time is not out.
So right. I think I have one more
left.
Minute.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Tom Leggins, and I represent the United States in this criminal appeal. I was also the counsel below for all of the proceedings, I believe, after the initial complaint was filed in January of 1998. Taking the arguments in the order that counsel presented them, Defendant Westmoreland asserts that he is entitled to a new trial based upon newly discovered evidence, primarily the newly discovered or alleged newly discovered evidence regarding the timeline of the affair and the alleged newly discovered evidence of the Milkovich recantation of his statement at the time of the defendant's arrest. The legal standard this court applies to a motion for new trial is of course, that the information was discovered after trial, that it could only have been discovered, or it could not have been discovered earlier except through due diligence, that the information is material, and I think most importantly, not only to this claim, but to all of the defendant's claims before this court, is that the information would likely have led to an acquittal. Getting back to the judge's question, is this, in fact, really newly discovered evidence? Our position would be that it's not. The evidence of the affair was disclosed upon the government finding out about it. The details concerning that affair was disclosed to the defense.
Speaking of details, there are phone records at some point that show hundreds of calls back and forth. At what point are those phone records disclosed?
We found out about the affair approximately a year before trial, and I think the investigation was completed by that fall, so they would have been disclosed within 6 or 8 months before trial. The phone records, in which both the government and the court relied heavily on those phone records for setting the timeline of the affair, because it showed no telephone contact between the defendant's wife and the investigator until the time period both of them said it began.
So those phone records included months prior to November of...
That is my recollection, yes. Yes, Your Honor. That the... once it became apparent that our lead agent needed to be investigated, that was turned over to another agency. And my recollection is that they went back during the entire relevant time period. Certainly, if they hadn't, the defense could have subpoenaed those records themselves. And that kind of gets back to the due diligence question, which was kind of mixed in with Your Honor's question about was this truly newly discovered evidence. One of the things you have to remember about this case is that it was originally a death penalty case, and because of that, the defense not only had two court-appointed attorneys, they also had a court-appointed investigator throughout this whole case. They had a court-appointed investigator that was able to look into anything they wanted to.
Including the drug, at the time of the drug trial?
No, not at the time. Once we sought the death penalty, which because of this affair we later relinquished, they had appointed two attorneys and an investigator because it was a death penalty case, and the court never took them off the case. The court never relinquished that death penalty appointment, even though...
So the death penalty appointment occurred after the drug trial was completed.
Yes. There was a drug trial. After the drug trial, we charged him with murder. We got permission from the Department of Justice to seek the death penalty. Then we found out about... And that's when they got the defense got the two appointed attorneys paid for by the government, the investigator paid for by the government, and even though we had to relinquish the death penalty because of the affair, the court never dissolved those appointments, and they in fact had an investigator. Their investigator was sitting in court throughout the whole trial. the murder trial.
Mr. Likens, if I could follow up, one of the issues, obviously, with some of the points the defense is raising is whether this evidence the defense says is new would have led to an acquittal.
Right.
We've got the victim's husband and the shooter both testifying about Mr. Westmoreland's role at trial, correct?
That is correct.
And you also had him on tape?
Yes.
I don't think we've had access, at least I haven't yet had an opportunity to see the transcripts of those. But when I do, what will they tell us?
They will tell you that after what happened was the victim's husband, who set up this murder with the defendant, went to the Illinois State Police to have to sit for a polygraph. He failed that polygraph miserably. Before going to take the polygraph, he had testified that he had stopped and had been advised by the defendant to take some Valium, that would help him pass it. After he confessed, he agreed to make tapes on behalf of the government, tape recorded conversations with the defendant. Those conversations are going to show the defendant, Westmoreland, reassuring Richard Ablin that the police were not going to be able to catch him, that the jewelry had been disposed of, which the robber had taken from the defendant, that if they told him anything otherwise, they were bluffing. There were references made to the Valium to beat the polygraph and how that hadn't happened. And you also had evidence of the defendant also just behaving, unless he was involved, really bizarrely. I mean, he was out at 5 o'clock. He came out to meet the defendant at 5 o'clock in the morning. He had left earlier, as I recall. This was in January on a night that was so foggy that the police were having trouble doing surveillance. He left his house in his underwear to get to a phone that he knew wasn't a payphone, so he could be sure he wasn't being listened to. I mean, there was, and I go through a lot of those facts in my statement of the facts to support that argument, that ultimately, with regard to all of the claims that the defendant makes before this court, all four of them, the ultimate question in all of them, really, when you boil it all down, is, was the correct decision reached here?
But the defendant, Westmoreland, is on tape assuring Abelm that the victim's jewelry had been disposed of.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There are, what, five calls, four calls?
Yes.
Both Ablin and the shooter testified in the murder trial?
Yes, they both testified against the defendant.
And implicated the defendant?
Yes, and we're consistent about what his role was as the middleman, basically. He brought the husband who wanted his wife dead together with the shooter who actually performed the murder.
Did Ablin ever recant before his death?
No, he did not.
And he's dead as of when?
He killed himself, I believe, right around the anniversary of the murder.
In 2002?
Yes. But no, and he never did. He never did recant. The shooter, DeAndre Lewis, has never recanted. And I guess, you know, that's really all the defendant can complain that they lost is the chance that Richard Ablin might have at some point recanted, because his testimony, even under Crawford, and the more recent rulings on the rules against hearsay, all of Richard Ablin's testimony was given under oath, subjected to rigorous cross-examination, and would still be admissible.
Mr. Liggins, let me ask you about the right to counsel question about 33 in our case in Kitchen. Let's suppose the case is a tougher one for the government. Let's suppose there is genuinely new evidence that is decisive, and a defense counsel after trial, for whatever reason, refuses to present it as part of the Rule 33 motion. The defendant is left to go pro se in pursuing the new trial. Should we look at that as a right to counsel issue? Should we look at it as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim under 2255? How would we should we approach that problem?
Yeah, I would, and again, this is just my gut feeling is that it would be approached as an ineffective assistance of counsel problem because my the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attaches to trial. It doesn't, for example, it doesn't attach to appellate, the constitutional right to counsel.
Now, once you've got a right of appeal, though, you've got a right to assistance in that first effective
right.
assistance in the first appeal. And Kitchen says you've also got that right extends to Rule 33 motions. Do we need to reconsider Kitchen to rule in your favor on this issue, or something else?
I don't know that reconsidering the rule would ultimately make a practical difference because the standard really. You still have to show actual prejudice under either approach. That is going to require the defendant to show that in the one instance that an acquittal would have been likely, or in the other instance that actual prejudice. And I'm not enough of a legal scholar to know what the difference is between them, but I know it's probably not much. And if there are no further questions, Your Honors,
I'm troubled, frankly. This motion was pending for 8 years in the district court.
Right.
Can you give us any insight as to what happened here?
Yeah, I was.
All three of us were district judges. I'm not saying I was first in time with everything done, but I'm really troubled by that delay.
The delay in the district court, I was expecting that the ruling on the motion for new trial would include an explanation for that. I can tell you what my assumption all along was. My assumption was that it was attributable to the fact that the defendant had filed an ARDC, a disciplinary complaint, against his trial attorneys. And I know I know just the vague outlines of what that was about because I was actually asked about it by the disciplinary authorities. That was an anomaly in the case because it took so long for that investigation to go on, and the only reason I thought it might be related is because the other anomaly with this case was it took so long. And so I thought those were related. I thought the ruling would reflect that, but it didn't.
The judge didn't explain it, I agree. But is the disposition of that ARDC complaint available in any public record of which we could take judicial notice?
I don't believe so, because I know, as I said, these defense attorneys were appointed pursuant to the CJA Act, and I know one of them is still a CJA attorney. So if there had been a disciplinary finding against them regarding their activities as a CJA attorney, I would assume that would no longer be the case.
Was one of the two of them the defense counsel on the drug trial? Did that counsel carry over to the murder trial, or were those two new lawyers?
No, Your Honor, they were two new lawyers. What happened was he had a separate counsel on the drug trial, Richard Burke. After his conviction on that trial, he hired Scott Rosenblum to handle his appeal, and then Rosenblum and Bert Shostak, an attorney in St. Louis, handled the trial and subsequent appeals after that until he filed the ARDC complaint against them.
Judge Hamilton explored this, the length of pendency, but you see cases coming out of that district court regularly. Is the length this motion was pending typical?
No, it is atypical. And in fact, I was a law clerk for a different chambers, and I know when I was law clerking, there was a 60-day list. I don't know if the suspense time is still the same. There was a 60-day list, a 6-month list, and I know for a fact from my time as a law clerk that this chambers in particular was kind of obsessive about that 60-day list and the 6-month list.
Thank you.
The 6-month list is familiar to all district judges.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. How much time? 1 minute.
Your Honors, I just have two brief points that I wanted to raise in rebuttal. One, the appellee mentions that there were phone records turned over regarding the timing of the affair, calls between Martin Milkovich and Bronnie Westmoreland, and that was a big piece of evidence showing this timeline. And, you know, and we're a bit limited by, you know, the record on appeal and not having access to the entire administrative transcripts that were presumably turned over before the trial. But from what we do have, and I know that we've included some in a brief and that were included in Westmoreland's initial brief, it's unclear to me it almost appears that there's a bit of a presumption going on with the internal investigation that the phone records are being collected based on the timeline that they're given. And it's not 100% clear to me, for example, there's transcript testimony discussing how you know, the statements given in the case by witnesses was that the affair, the relationship became personal in 99, so that's why the records reflect that date, and that's why the phone calls are from that time period. So it's not entirely clear to me that there was this overwhelming evidence. And I see that my time is up, Your Honor. I did have one brief other point, but I'd be happy to...
Go ahead.
All right, thank you. One point as well that the appellee mentioned is questioning whether there was really any prejudice resulting from this lack of counsel. And we would argue that there was severe prejudice because, again, my client did not file his reply papers until 2004, and so he would have had an attorney to help with those papers. In addition, the evidence of the Milkovich recantation did not take place until 2004 as well. So, again, an attorney would have been instrumental there, and I just wanted to highlight that point for the court. Unless there's any further questions, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, counsel. And my understanding is that, Ms. Berger, you accepted the appointment and as well as your firm?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you have the thanks of the court for your acceptance of the appointment, and as usual, your firm has done an excellent job.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel.
Thank you.